Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic on the 60 westbound, a crash is blocking the Power Road exit ramp. Also watch out for accidents 101 southbound at Broadway, that's in the East Valley, and I-10 westbound at Elliott. It'll stay mostly sunny for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 67 degrees. Some clouds tonight, overnight lows in the mid-40s. Sunny and 66 tomorrow, 64 for a high on Wednesday. Right now, it's partly sunny and 63 degrees. Tucson this week is set to launch a new program which aims to give homeless residents day work and pay them for it. It's modeled after a similar effort in Albuquerque. City Councilman Richard Fimbres is one of those behind this program in Tucson, which also includes a number of nonprofits there. And Councilman, what in your mind is the ultimate goal of doing this?
I think it's better to generate more services and identify these folks and help us clean up our streets and our areas where we're going to be placing them to do very small cleanups, and then also it's to help get them the services.
Do you see this as a way to try to end homelessness in Tucson?
I don't know if we'll ever end homelessness. I just think that it's a better way to navigate them through and let them identify services.
How much money is the city and the county putting to this now? And I'm curious if you think that this is a sustainable thing for you guys to keep doing.
I think it's we are initially kicking off from our litter fee, $25,000, and the county is matching that out of their fund. So we're going to do the same startup as they did in Albuquerque, which is $50,000. We've already had some business people step up and said if the city and the county match it, put that money up, we'll match it. I think with all the partners we have already secured, Caridad is covering the meals, El Pueblo is providing the services and the management, Simpatico is covering the cost for the navigator, and St. Andrews is providing the showers, and El Rio is doing the health care. I think that we can, ours is will kick off a little bit better because we don't have to pay for those services.
What does the city get out of this?
Oh, better city, better clean city. Help us look at some of these areas where we need to clean up. It'll help us identify some of these individuals that need better services. I think if you look in the long run, emergency room costs are pretty expensive. And jail bed costs for the city of Tucson are pretty expensive also. So if this can help folks and put them in a better positive path, then I don't think we need to use those type of services.
Richard Fimbres is a Tucson City Councilman. The city is set to launch its program tomorrow. Albuquerque started its plan called There's a Better Way last September, picking up homeless residents and giving them jobs 2 days a week. It's now expanded to 4 days, and the city's contribution has also grown from $50,000 at the outset to $181,000 now. The program was the idea of Albuquerque Mayor Richard Berry, who says it makes the city look better, but more importantly, changes residents' lives.
So as much as Better Way in Albuquerque is a program about making our city more attractive, it's really a program about connecting people to the services that they need to improve their circumstances. And it's just wonderful to see how the dignity of a day's work puts them in a position to do that.
Berry says since the program started last year, workers have removed more than 100,000 pounds of trash from the city and 20 residents have gotten housing. The city is the sole financial supporter of There's a Better Way, and even though Berry only has one more year as mayor, he's optimistic his successor will keep it going.
At some point in time, we always, as elected officials, we have to take limited resources and put them to the highest and best use. It'll be up to the next administration to decide that. I believe we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that that's the case, and we'll be hopeful.
Berry says the program could work in any size city. In fact, he says he recently got a call from Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who plans to adapt it for his city. Berry says Denver is poised to do the same. To get more of a sense of the effect the program has had on Albuquerque, I'm joined by Kelly Tillerson. She's the Director of Employment Services at St. Martin's Hospitality Center there, which runs the program for the city. And Kelly, what kind of impact have you seen since you started doing this?
We've seen a pretty large impact on our panhandling and homeless population here in Albuquerque. At last count, we have provided close to 1,200 jobs to an unduplicated 400-plus people here in the city. And by giving them the opportunity to work for cash at the end of the day, it's motivating people to get connected to other services that they otherwise may or may not have known existed.
Do you find that by getting these homeless people into a day-type job, does that sort of help them get back into the overall labor market?
Absolutely. A lot of the people that we're encountering haven't worked in a long time. It's really, we've seen kind of a transition in a lot of people saying, you know what, I didn't think I could still work. I didn't think that I could go looking the way that I look or work because of my housing situation. So they're getting out there, working that first day, saying, you know, this really does work for me. I can do this.
When you pay the workers, you pay them in cash, is that right?
That's right.
Are there tax implications to basically paying people in cash and not having it be reported?
So we track every worker, so we know exactly how many times they've worked and how much that they've made. So when they start getting close to that $600 mark, which is that maximum that anyone can make without having to do a 1099 and report taxes and all of that, when they start getting close, we have them fill out the 1099 paperwork and let them know that we will be reporting it to the IRS, that they have made X amount of dollars, and that it will be up to them to report and pay those taxes if they exceed that $600 limit.
So given your experience with this program now in its second year, what advice would you give to folks in Tucson as they're just sort of embarking on this for how they can make sure that the program is successful and sustainable and is able to do what they would like for it to do?
I would say the biggest part is community collaboration on this project, because you need the buy-in of not only the citizens of Tucson, but you need the police department on board. You need social service agencies on board. Everyone willing to take those referrals and really kind of shift the way that they view panhandling and that they view homelessness. Because, for example, the Albuquerque Police Department, we've seen a shift in the way that they're communicating with the panhandlers. They're no longer citing them for panhandling. Instead, they're offering resource cards and sometimes even driving them to our facility and dropping them off saying, I met this person on the street corner and they need help with X, Y, and Z, so we brought them here in hopes that you can help them. And then they transition into our programs and get the help that they're so desperately seeking. So I think as long as the community is on board and understanding what the point of the program is, that it will definitely be successful.
Kelly Tillerson is the Director of Employment Services at St. Martin's Hospitality Center in Albuquerque. The governors of Arizona and the neighboring Mexican state of Sonora have partnered to attract businesses that will employ workers on both sides of the border. This despite the fact that trade policies between the U.S. and other countries are in a moment of uncertainty. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports.
El gobernador de Arizona, Honorable Doug Ducey. Escuchamos.
Governor Doug Ducey is wearing a black suit and on his jacket a pin that shines with the flag of Arizona on one half and the flag of Mexico on the other.
Buenas tardes.
Ducey is speaking at a just-completed meeting of the Arizona-Sonora Commission. A few hundred business and government leaders gathered in Hermosillo, the capital of Sonora. And quickly, Ducey turns to a recent accomplishment. He says Lucid Motors will hire 2,000 people to build electronic vehicles in Pinal County. And he says the company chose that location because of its proximity to manufacturers in Sonora.
Taking full advantage of our geography alongside Sonora and its integrated supply chain. This is a major win for Arizona, Sonora, and our entire region.
Soon after, Ducey's counterpart, Sonora Governor Claudia Pavlovich, welcomes him.
Governor Ducey, thank you for being here. Thank you for your friendship, for your leadership, and for being such a good partner.
Pavlovich lists a few of the benefits of what the two governors call the Arizona-Sonora mega region, a supply chain that can connect the center of Mexico to the American West Coast and access to relatively inexpensive labor.
La relación binacional también la podemos hacer los gobiernos locales.
Binational relations can be built by local governments, she says. And she adds, they should benefit Sonora and Arizona. This collaboration between Ducey and Pavlovich is in contrast with the hard line President-elect Donald Trump is drawing. Last week, he got air conditioner manufacturer Carrier to outsource fewer jobs to Mexico. And yesterday, he promised to impose a 35% tax on companies that fire American workers and build plants elsewhere. Gonzalo Rodriguez is an economist with the Sonora Regional Center of Innovation. He says that factory workers in the U.S. depend on supplies from Mexico.
What is best for the United States is the prosperity of the United States and the prosperity of Mexico, because if both are prosperous communities, they will be better off.
But manufacturing is only part of what links Arizona and Sonora. At the summit, there were people like Bruce McKee. He works for a company called Amoresco in Gilbert, Arizona. He helps local governments and businesses decide when and where to buy electricity and gas.
I just concluded a budget forecast for 2017 for one of our clients, and it was in excess of $340 million.
Just for energy?
Just for energy.
McKee came to the summit because he wants to learn how to better help a company from Arizona that already operates in Mexico.
I can't really obviously tell you what the customer's name is, but they're a big user, and they make household products that we all use every day.
There were also Mexican business people like Arturo Fernandez, who's a partner in a holding company called Helios.
We're into 10 different industries, including car dealerships, with mills. It's a very diversified group.
Fernandez has been working for years on a project to invest in a solar energy farm.
We want to do something in Mexico first, and then we would contemplate doing a project or something like that in the United States.
Which is what brings him to this conference.
Well, it's very efficient because you have a concentration of people that are in the industry, and then you don't have to travel to the U.S. to because they're already here.
Fernandez lives in Hermosillo and smiles when he says that he drove only 5 minutes to the conference. A similar one will take place next summer in Arizona. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, reporting in Hermosillo, Sonora.
According to economists, 2016 was the year Arizona finally recovered the 300,000-plus jobs it lost during the Great Recession. This was one of the last states to do that. So what does 2017 hold? The W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU sought answers today at its annual economic forecast. Lee McFeeters, research professor of economics at the Carey School, was one of the presenters, and he joins me. So, Lee, what is the jobs outlook for Arizona over the next, say, 6 to 12 months?
Well, it's, I think, very likely that we're on a trajectory that we see here at the end of 2016 that's going to continue on into 2017, where the types of jobs that are being created are very much aimed at the skilled and higher educated labor market. For example, just based on the numbers that we have through towards the end of 2016, we're looking at Arizona growing over 5% in financial sector jobs. That puts us number two in the country in the rate of growth in finance. It's not the case that what is driving the economy here is the service jobs in retail and restaurants and so forth. We're very much in the forefront among all states, I think, in quality job growth right now.
One of the things that economists have been tracking, as you obviously know, throughout the recession and looking at the state's unemployment rate is this so-called group of discouraged workers, folks who basically just stopped looking for a job because they hadn't been finding one, didn't think they could. Is there still a big group of those folks out there who could potentially re-enter the workforce?
The indicator that economists often follow instead of the unemployment rate is we look at the ratio of employment to population. That gives you a read on, of the whole population, what percent are working. And comparing Arizona to other states, that number in Arizona is just lower than the national average. It's lower than many other states. I think we're in the bottom 10 states for participation. So, you know, by that standard, we have a lot of people on the sidelines that are not in the labor force right now.
Do you think that the workers who are on the sidelines and their skills match up with the type of jobs that are being created here?
That's really a key question. When we do surveys of small business and ask them what are their top five problems, this sort of thing, one of the issues that always comes up is that they have unfilled positions and they're having trouble finding qualified workers.
I think as an economist, my response would be that you're having trouble finding workers at the wage rate that you're paying right now. And this is one of the stories of Arizona. Our wages and job-for-job compensation tends to be a bit lower than the national average and even some of our neighboring states. And so we're expecting to see wages continuing to go up as businesses seek to hire more and more workers here as the economy keeps expanding.
But at a certain point, though, it doesn't come down to wages, I would think, right? I mean, if, as you said earlier, financial services is one of the sectors that's growing. If you have a bunch of workers who have been looking for jobs and then stopped, who have no experience in that sector, the business could pay a gazillion dollars a year and it wouldn't help, right?
Yeah, I think that there's some serious structural issues there. And we know what the answer is. The answer is well known. It is education. It is training programs. But, you know, look at Arizona's education budgets just all the way up from K-12 through the universities. We've simply not made education funding a priority here in the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, that is an issue, I think, especially the way the economy is changing so rapidly. And the question is, how do you describe the Arizona economy? If you want to look at the headlines, you can say Arizona is a top 10 state for job growth, a top 10 state for population growth. But we have some structural issues here that need to be dealt with. We're a bottom 10 state for poverty. We're a bottom 10 state for output per worker, bottom 10 state for per capita personal income. These are long-term issues that are not getting better, they're getting worse. And what needs to be done, I think, is in spite of the fact that we're very, very pleased with the way that these headline job growth numbers come out month after month, I think that we need to take a long, hard look at the Arizona economy in terms of prosperity measures like per capita income, per capita GDP, and these sorts of issues. And of course, as an academic, I would suggest that education is probably one of the key instruments that you would use to try to improve those prosperity measures.
Lee McFeeters is a research professor of economics at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody. In the news from North Dakota, we can report this story, a victory, in fact, in a battle that, if it had stretched into 2017, could have defined the Trump administration's early days.
Today, the Department of Army, Joe Allen Darcy, contacted me and said the Corps of Engineers is going to deny the easement.
You pray to experience this, but when it actually happened, I don't know what to feel. I really don't. I can't even come up with the words right now.
Joyful protesters from Standing Rock yesterday. That last voice was Brandy King, an Iraq vet who'd come to defend the land with protesters, courtesy of PRI reporter Jasmine Garst. The Army Corps of Engineers said that the pipeline in question will be rerouted to come nowhere near Indian land, and a full environmental impact statement will be done suggesting that the pipeline may never be built at all. Over 2,000 veterans have arrived at the site to act as human shields during any confrontations between police and protesters. Filmmaker Josh Fox returned from his second trip to Standing Rock and was in our studio. He's director of the film Gasland, and victory was all over his face.
This is about resistance actually working. And we've seen this time and time again in the environmental movement, and now for certainly with this indigenous sovereignty struggle with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe combined with climate activists and fracking activists. When we organize, we win. When we put our bodies on the line, we win. When people embody the spirit of peaceful resistance, which you've seen in so many of these historic struggles across history, we win. So that's what's happening today.
Well, in the sacred land argument, they could move the pipeline, and that will deal with that. But the use of the pipeline as a fossil fuel source of our energy, it doesn't change the environmental equation at all.
Well, I don't know if that's true. I mean, and it remains to be seen. An environmental impact study is something that's really a thing. You know, that takes a while to complete.
So the possibility exists that the pipeline wouldn't be built at all.
I think so. And I think Energy Transfer Partners kind of deserves it for literally bulldozing through their way through sacred lands. I mean, this tribe notified Energy Transfer Partners that they were approaching a sacred burial ground. And the day that they did that, they accelerated their construction to literally bulldoze it on purpose. And then you saw them defending that with attack dogs, which actually bit protesters. The government of North Dakota, along with Energy Transfer Partners, has been behaving as a rogue establishment without any regard for peace, for safety, certainly for the environment. So when you do that, which is so typical of oil and gas, it is only thing that's remarkable about this decision is actually sanity has prevailed and the government has actually stood up to the oil and gas industry, which very, very rarely happens. But all credit goes to the peaceful protectors who put themselves on the line to actually block the pipeline.
But in terms of the chain of command, the federal government has intervened and overruled the interests at the state level, who are much more interested and are much closer to the pipeline company.
Well, I wouldn't say intervened. Again, this is a process. This is a regulatory framework. I mean, the Army Corps of Engineers has that land, and it does so to contain interests that would ordinarily be rapacious towards the environment. Look, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe has a real point when they say this is our only watershed and these pipelines are very dangerous. We've had 3,300 major pipeline leaks in the United States between 2010 and 2015. The Yellowstone River, the Kalamazoo River, the beaches of Santa Barbara, Mayflower, Arkansas, an entire town that had to be abandoned because suburban garages are filling up with crude oil when their pipeline breaks. These things happen very, very frequently. And the reason why is because the pipeline industry, in my humble opinion, is operating in a state of criminal negligence. They do not pay attention to the fact that the regulatory framework is very, very weak, and these guys would rather pollute environments than have to pay extra to make these pipelines safer.
What's the precedent here? What has been seen by the federal government and the Army Corps to have been the supreme law of the land here?
Yeah. Well, I think that the precedent is when a company behaves in the way that Energy Transfer Partners has been doing and literally using the police as their own private security firm. Remember, Kelsey Warren, the billionaire at the head of this pipeline, has offered to reimburse the North Dakota Police Department for their expenses. If that's not hiring, you know, the cops as your own private security force for your billion-dollar environmentally insane oil pipeline project, I don't know what is. So the precedent is when you behave in this way, as the oil industry does very typically throughout the United States, fracking, pipelines, mountaintop removal, all the things that the extractive energy industry does, the precedent is, okay, wait a minute, stop. We're in the 21st century now. You simply can't bulldoze people. You can't run over indigenous rights. You can't run over human rights in your quest, especially now that we don't need oil pipelines, right? We have other technologies. We have wind, we have solar, we have geothermal. We have other ways of producing energy that are far more environmentally friendly, and people want them.
What message was sent by the veterans who showed up over the last few days?
What the veterans did was they exposed the deep racism and violence of the North Dakota police force, the Morton County Sheriff's Office, because what they were saying is, you want to shoot at people? You want to shoot at unarmed folks? You want to take rubber bullets and water cannons and throw concussion grenades at people? Do it through us. We're the people who has stood up for the Constitution. And one of them, I think, brilliantly said, we took an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So what that person was saying, what that veteran was saying was, the Energy Transfer Partners is an enemy to the United States Constitution. And I would agree with that, because these people would rather torch our civil rights and our human rights than stop the flow of oil from the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, which, as I said, is unnecessary and is one of those things that will spiral climate change out of control.
There are murals all over the Northwest that tell the story of agreements made and broken between tribes and the federal government. Do you think this will turn out that way?
I don't know. I mean, I think, look, this is a temporary victory, But the power of the people is never temporary. So we're seeing people who are not going to leave until finally this pipeline is defeated. And, you know, today was the day that the Army Corps of Engineers and the North Dakota governor was to say, you are going to be evicted from this protest camp. Today happens to be the birthday of General Custer. So the irony is not lost on the fact that just as Custer was defeated, so this pipeline will be. And that, I think, is really one of the takeaways to learn from this today.
Josh Fox is the director of Gasland, Gasland 2, and most recently, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. He recently returned from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota, where he was filming the protests there. Thanks so much, Josh.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
And Mark, 2016 will certainly go down as a year of change, not only in Washington, D.C., but in Arizona's largest county as well.
Yeah, Maricopa County will say farewell to some high-profile mainstays, including Sheriff Joe Arpaio and County Recorder Helen Purcell.
And somewhat lost among those departures is a public official that has also served for many years, Supervisor Andrew Kunasik.
He's represented District 3, which includes parts of Phoenix and the county's north-central region, including Anthem, New River, and Paradise Valley, for the past 19 years. Kunasik chose not to run for re-election this year. Here's what he'll miss about the job.
Interacting with the people, the constituents, the residents of the county.
But what he won't miss is the politics and gamesmanship that goes along with the position.
I didn't enjoy it so much, and so I would see oftentimes people playing politics when the real result from those games, was that, you know, there was waste.
I sat down with the man who's been a fixture in Maricopa about the changes he's seen, including some 2 million additional residents in the county since he was first elected in 1997.
We have probably about the same number of employees that we did when I started, and we've had incredible growth. When I took office, we were, quite frankly, we're buried in long-term debt. They were borrowing money to make payroll, short-term, you know, basically a revolving credit lines at the local bank for $100 million plus. And we made a conscious decision and effort, not just me, but, you know, Jan Brewer was, I think, the first convert to that. And over the years, we got there. So we're the largest government in the country with no debt. We've used technology, I think, to better serve the public with fewer people.
Speaking of the election, it brought about some big changes. There's going to be a new sheriff, a new county recorder. Does that sort of signal a changing of the guard here? Is it time for fresh faces and voices in Maricopa County?
I believe there is, but I wouldn't put the recorder and the sheriff in the same category. I think the fact is the voters changed them both. You know, I personally think they got it wrong with Helen. I think she took a bad rap. I look at her batting 1,000 for her 20 years there, really did a fantastic job. But I guess your last at bat might be the one that people remember. On the other hand, the sheriff, I did not enjoy the last couple of terms especially.
That would be an understatement. Kunasik and other county administrators were investigated by Arpaio and former county attorney Andrew Thomas for government corruption. Kunasik later won a settlement for the false claims made by Arpaio and Thomas.
We're all raised to believe and trust the police. When one's bad, when one goes bad, it really is a shock to our way of life, the way we look at things. You know, people always want to say there's nothing worse than a dirty cop or a corrupt cop. I think it's far worse if you have a corrupt prosecutor. I do think, you know, Joe and some of his upper echelon of people, should have resisted their urges that were accommodated by a rogue prosecutor and a prosecuting attorney and Andrew Thomas. So it was time for him to go.
Did Sheriff Arpaio go bad? Do you think that he started off 2 decades ago with good intentions, and what happened if he did go bad?
I think he did so much that brought him personally a lot of admiration from the public. But I think it went to his head. I really think, and as somebody that set the budget over the years for that office, there seemed to be an inordinate amount of resource that went to what I would call the care and feeding of Joe.
And we touched on one other controversial topic as he leaves office, the proliferation of sports stadiums and arenas, and the public money that teams are demanding from municipalities to help fund and support them. In his last year in office, Kunasic went after the Diamondbacks and owner Ken Kendrick in a profanity-laced tirade against the team's threat to move from Chase Field unless the county agreed to $187 million in renovations and upgrades.
There is a lot of pressure. I don't think you can dispute that there is economic benefit. I think it really helps when you have a winning team, and a lot of times, even without a winning team, if you have a demonstrated commitment from the ownership, that if they're truly embedded in the community. I look at I think a lot of people look at the Cardinals this year. We had high hopes, and things were going to be great, and hadn't worked out that way. Same thing with the Diamondbacks, to put the two together. I think there was probably a lot of people watching the Diamondbacks locally that said they got what they deserved. I mean, the way they treated the public, the taxpayer, the elected officials, they got what they deserved. I'm a fan of sports, but I also don't like the idea of somebody making a chump of you. You pay a lot of money, whether it's ASU and over and over and over, people, season ticket holders, and there doesn't seem to be the same commitment from the top over there. I feel like at some point they're playing us all for fools.
That's Maricopa County Supervisor Andy Kunasic leaving office after 19 years. He'll be replaced by Phoenix City Councilman Bill Gates, who won election last month to fill the seat.
Well, Phil, does he know what he's going to do next?
Yeah, I asked him, Mark. He's not sure, but he says he's not ruling out a return to politics, possibly on the state level as a legislator. You get the feeling he does really care about public service.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Mark.
Mandarin is the most widely spoken first language in the world, and fluency could mean more opportunities in the workforce. That's why some parents here want their kids to speak it too, even if they don't speak it themselves.
It's a little bit intimidating, but I do realize this is a changing world, and we need to support our children. And if this is what's the right thing for them in terms of their personal development, you're willing to stretch.
That's Maria Aldrich attending a meeting at Desert Canyon Elementary School in Scottsdale. She's planning to enroll her daughter in the school's new Mandarin immersion program, which starts next school year. Students will spend half of each day being taught in Mandarin, which led parent Jennifer DaCosta to wonder what homework help will be like.
It's going to be a challenge, recognizing has he learned what he needs to learn, as well as is he learning the Mandarin properly, because I don't know any Mandarin to be able to help him.
Students who opt into the program will learn math, science, and Chinese language arts from a native Mandarin speaker only teaching in Mandarin. The other half of the day would be spent on reading, writing, and social studies in English. Kristen Kinghorn is the principal at Desert Canyon Elementary. And Kristen, what gave you the idea to do this?
Well, it's something that's new and upcoming in the Valley. We're following a little bit after Utah. Utah has over 30 immersion programs in their state. But when you look at the competitiveness of the global economy and our mission, that is to prepare students to be a global citizen, they need to have a foreign language. We want to prepare them for business. And when you look at Bloomberg's business, the languages of business, Mandarin is number two right behind English. So there's so many benefits to learning Mandarin that we decided to go with Mandarin, not Spanish.
Do you have a cost estimate for this program?
It's not anything that would be anything bigger than adding any program, because the teacher takes care of it itself, because the enrollment continues to go up. And when we look at our staffing, our enrollment will drive our staffing. So there's a need for the teacher due to the enrollment. So that is kind of a wash on the cost. And then because we're teaching the math and we're teaching science in the target language, that's how we're teaching that piece, then the only added on cost is the Chinese language arts. And so that's a very minimal cost of doing some Chinese readers.
I'm curious about the decision to teach math and science in Mandarin, because I wonder, especially for kindergartners, first graders, sort of the early grades there, some of the concepts that they'll be learning about in math and science are confusing in English, much less in a foreign language.
And when you look at research, will show that kiddos who start in foreign language immersion programs, their problem-solving skills are higher than their non-immersion peers. And that is because they're doing a lot of the math in a different language. Math also, though, too, can be modeled using visuals and manipulatives that the kids then are using more problem-solving skills, communication. They're collaborating with their peers on how to solve these math concepts.
What kinds of questions and comments have you been hearing from parents in your district?
We get a lot of why Mandarin, and a lot of parents want to know why not Spanish. And we talk about the complexity of the language. Mandarin is a very complex language because of the tones and the dialects. And they talk about, well, why do you start in kindergarten? Why not you start in fifth grade? And we talk about the benefits of starting at the early age with the brain and the way that the kids can absorb the language and how the brain develops. So we give them some of that research base and some of the facts behind of why we're doing Mandarin. And we also look at the Department of Defense recently did a study that adults were learning different languages and they were immersed into these different languages. And Spanish was considered a category one language, meaning it only took them 26 weeks to become proficient in that language in Spanish. But if they wanted to do Mandarin, it was going to take them up to 64 weeks to become proficient and to speak like a native speaker. So we want to make sure we're targeting them at this early age with a complex language.
Do you expect that more schools across the valley or across Arizona will start doing this sort of thing?
Absolutely. It's becoming bigger. You have quite a few schools that are already doing it. You've got some in Deer Valley and Cave Creek and Chandler and Higley. And I think that you'll start to see as the movement comes to become more global that you will start to see Mandarin pop up more and more. Because Spanish was such a heavy foundation, we have so many Spanish immersion schools already. There are preschools that are already offering immersion programs in Mandarin. And so now we need those kiddos to go somewhere when they get to kindergarten age. And so I think you'll start to see more.
Kristen Kinghorn is the principal at Desert Canyon Elementary School in the Scottsdale Unified School District. Kristen, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Arizona's urban counties saw the biggest drop in teen birth rates in the country between 2007 and last year. That's according to new numbers from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The declines in Arizona's rural counties were less pronounced. With me to talk about this is Bree Thomas, CEO of the Arizona Family Health Partnership. And Bree, what do you make of this data from the CDC showing declining teen birth rates and Arizona seemingly leading the way, at least as far as urban counties?
So the urban counties, Pima and Maricopa County, had a significant drop in the teen birth rates. If you look at our rural counties, some of them weren't as significant. And to me, that is access to care. That is the ability to access reproductive health care that is the difference between the urban and the rural areas.
So basically, in the cities, women have access to that kind of care, and in rural areas, they don't?
Correct.
Or have less of it?
Have less of it. And timely. So making sure that they can get in a timely fashion and then making sure that they're able to access the prescription or medication either same day or very soon thereafter.
Do you attribute any of this to educational factors or anything other than just the fact that women in these urban counties have access to all the things that you mentioned?
I would attribute it to two things. There are birth control methods that are considered long-acting reversible contraceptives. There's less user error, so they're higher efficacy types of birth control methods, and so more people are using them. And then I would say education, but I wouldn't say education in the typical sense. I would say that teens have access via their smartphone information that they may want to get, and that information is medically accurate, scientific information that they can say, what kind of birth control method do I want?
Do you find that teens are more likely to get that kind of information or look for that kind of information if it's, for lack of a better word, anonymous, if it's online, if they don't have to talk to somebody, they don't have to show their face in a doctor's office, for example?
Correct. I think it's that. And I think they also can do it in the privacy of their coffee shop or their car, if they're not driving, or, you know, in their bedroom. They're able to actually pull up information. And we developed a website specifically for teens called sexfyi.org so that they could just look at birth control methods and where to get it.
Is there a danger, though, that if teen girls, for example, don't know your URL, that they might just Google it and come up with something that isn't medically accurate.
Yes, there's that danger, and there's danger that the website might not be appropriate. So, you know, you want them to be careful. And so that's why we tried to get the information out about sexfyi.org so people would know that this is, you know, a nonprofit that has 45 years experience of doing this work. You know, the CDC oftentimes comes up as well, so they're a nationally recognized source of information, but there is always that concern that it might not be medically accurate information if you Google it.
So in the rural counties in Arizona, mm-hmm. in your mind, is the answer, and I don't mean simple as like it's easy to do, but in theory, as simple as just getting more access to care and more access to prescriptions and medication that women need?
I think it's information and access to care. So teens and or families need to know that this exists, that they have access to reproductive health care in their community, and then they need to be able to get in a timely fashion.
So Arizona obviously led the country in urban counties in the decline mm-hmm. in teen birth rates. Where is the state overall as far as teen births? I mean, is the state doing okay in that regard?
We're still ranking pretty high with teen births. The last time I looked, we were 12th in the country with teen births. So everybody's coming down. But Arizona has come down a lot more.
Is that because we had farther to go than some other states?
I think that has a lot to do with it, but we also have had an increase in population. So, you know, when you start looking at numbers like that, and I'm not an epidemiologist, but I have staff that are, and they would caution me to say, you know, you have to be careful because demographics also, an increase in folks as well.
So what does Arizona have to do overall, do you think, to really bring those rates down and get them to what folks like yourself would consider an acceptable level?
Well, it's policy changes and its funding. So Arizona provides no state funds for reproductive health care. And so I think what Arizona has to do is invest in access to care and reproductive health care, as well as provide the information to the citizens of Arizona.
Bree Thomas is the CEO of Arizona Family Health Partnership. Bree, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We hear this every 4 years or so, that Americans unhappy with the result of the presidential election are going to move to Canada. And while who doesn't love Molson and the Hansen brothers, some American politicos are suggesting instead of moving north, their compatriots should move to a swing state. And at least one such blog post has listed Arizona as one of the top five states that Democrats, in the case of this year's election, could make a difference in 2020. For more on this, I'm joined by Joe Yuhas. He's a public affairs and political consultant with 1025 Public Affairs and himself a transplanted Arizonan by way of New Jersey. And Joe, what do you make of this idea of people suggesting instead of going to Canada, Dems should instead move to a swing state?
Well, I think, Mark, we're going to have to let things sort of settle in for a while. I don't think this mass exodus to other countries was ever real, genuine. But I think there is some truth to this sense that if you really want to make a difference, move to a state that can make a difference. Because we really don't have, and we haven't had for some time now, a national presidential election. What we've had is an election that is primarily determined by 10 or 12 states, the so-called swing states, you know, that may, come into play in any given cycle. And you see that just in terms of where the candidates spend their time and their money. So the truth of the matter is, just as the candidates devote their attention to those handful of states that are swing states, it's plausible that people may make a conscious decision, especially in these times when, you know, we're such a more transient society, and that certainly is the case here in Arizona. Is it enough to make a difference? I'm not so sure about that. I think what's going to happen inevitably, especially in a state like Arizona, other transient states like Florida, that both the in-migration of new residents, but also the changing demographics of each state, you know, are going to determine, you know, where that state is going politically.
Well, do you think that those demographics ideally shift sort of on their own, or because it seems like this is sort of like engineering a demographic shift?
Yeah, I don't think that's really in the cards. I can't see. I can't even imagine. I mean, I think this article opined in a sort of a whimsical way, you know, how the politics of the nation can be impacted really by the changes in a relatively handful of states. And we've seen that already. As those states change and evolve, well, you know, it's certainly going to have an impact on our national elections. But I can't imagine that it certainly would affect the politics in that state, particularly, for example, in a state like Arizona, where a ballot measure state, you know, the recent passage of the minimum wage measure is a good example. We have a reputation as a conservative state, yet the minimum wage measure, you know, passed by a pretty healthy margin. So, you know, when the voting population changes, as it has here in Arizona, that certainly impacts public policy, especially in a ballot measure state. The real impact, I think, of this kind of migration is necessarily what can happen politically on a national level. It's more about what can happen in each one of those states.
Well, and you are someone, Joe, who moved to Arizona from what is considered a blue state, and you've worked on some causes that are not consistent necessarily with Arizona's reputation, as you say, as a conservative state. Do you think that there are enough people who are willing to move and look at this as a factor in their decision to move to a place relative to all the other factors that people look at when they're deciding to pick up and move?
Mark, I'm sorry to say this, but in the times that we live in, I'm afraid that we didn't have great nationwide participation in the most recent presidential election. I think people were clearly turned off. I think people are turned off with the process. It has had, I think, and I'm not talking about the ultimate outcome, but the process itself has frankly turned people off. I think that politics is one of, now as a result, is one of the least important considerations when folks decide to make a move, you know, to another state.
So do you foresee Democrats in Arizona maybe trying to lure people here? Maybe, you know, marketing campaigns, I'm picturing like, hey, it's not just great for winter weather and golf anymore. Come and, you know, change the political swing of the state.
I think the Democratic Party has other requirements and needs to spend its limited resources than to simply try to encourage folks to move.
Not part of the new tourism campaign, huh?
No, I don't think so, and I don't think the current administration at the Capitol is going to incorporate that into any tourism promotion effort. But I think it's just going to happen on its own. You know, I think that a good chunk of our new residents that come to Arizona, for example, come from California. That's going to have an impact. So these new voters who come from other communities, they come here for other reasons, but they also know that in the community that they left, there were certain assets and opportunities that, you know, maybe aren't here, maybe you're lacking, that need to be met here in Arizona. And those folks are going to affect the process, both by getting involved politically, who they support as a candidate, and also, again, on the ballot measure front.
Joe Juhas is a public affairs and political consultant with 1025 Public Affairs. Many of us need a good cup of coffee to help us through the morning, but there is a side to this brewed beverage that often goes unnoticed. The show's Blake Bernard visits with Blue House Coffee and explores the growing world of specialty coffee.
Here you go. That's a Sumatran cold brew.
Yep, that's a high-octane coffee nectar.
It really, like, blasts your mouth with this flavor.
You may be longing for a cup of coffee right now. And if the words cold brew, Ethiopian blend, and cascara sound foreign, you're not alone.
And then be like, whoa, all right, like, wow, this is a really different tasting coffee because, you know, this is something I've never had before type of thing.
Let's talk specialty coffee, not the stuff you usually get at your morning drive-through. Sam Beeger is from Blue House Coffee, a mobile coffee vendor that travels around the Phoenix area. Today, they're at the Uptown Farmers Market in North Phoenix, serving up a distinctive coffee treat. The Nitro Cold Brew.
Cold brew for basically an iced coffee in which instead of you making it hot and then cooling it down, you brew it for an extended period of time in a cold temperature. You end up getting this really smooth cup of coffee that's about a third less acidic.
But there is a twist.
I'm just going to put a little more nitro in this.
Hear that? That's the sound of pressurization right there. We put it on nitrogen to basically give it a little more of a like a kind of sweet and creamy flavor to it.
If you've seen Guinness, it's similar, but we just don't put it on long enough so it's not like frizzy like that.
According to the National Coffee Association, the daily consumption of gourmet coffee beverages has more than doubled since 2008 among millennials, and the overall use of personal drip brewers has declined. This has led to the creation of companies like Blue House, an increase in coffee houses nationwide, and even more growth in what is called a coffee culture.
There is a really small but very talented coffee specialty coffee community in Arizona.
And while the coffee community in Phoenix is still small, it is growing. In the case of Blue House, they're trying to stand out by delivering their coffee via a custom-built mobile station.
We actually had our friend who's an industrial design student at ASU build a kind of a prototype. My brother Ian did a lot of the construction work.
It's simply a cruiser bike with two back wheels and a trailer attached. That trailer is rigged to house the nitrogen tanks, coffee, and tap system. It can hold up to 500 pounds. Blue House says the idea came from the desire to bring specialty coffee to people rather than have people come to them.
The cool thing about being mobile, is, especially with us, is that we bring specialty coffee to people to where they already are, to events.
The mobile idea started just off ASU's Tempe campus. Here's Blue House barista Sean Magruder.
We were really able to cultivate an area, a space for people to have coffee, enjoy the weather, enjoy talking with people they may have never known before who just happened to be sitting there. It kind of transformed that spot.
A big part of the coffee culture is education. Since the primary conditions for growing coffee exist in subtropical regions, the process of making specialty coffee typically starts outside the U.S. borders. Sam just returned from a trip to Colombia with the Coffee Roasters Guild.
We toured about a dozen farms to basically learning about the whole process from the actual seed of the, like, the cultivation of the coffee to actually exporting and processing and all the stuff that's involved with it. And it was an amazing experience.
So I actually took this video in Colombia.
Oh, that's you doing that?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's sweet. Okay. So,
but even with trips to Colombia and traveling around the valley, Blue House plans to stay with their mobile shop.
If anything, we'll build more carts and so we can go to more events and go to places where people already are. If we did build a cafe, I think it would be as much of a place where we roast our coffee as anything else.
And now, just one thing left to do.
You want to try some coffee?
For the show, I'm Blake Bernard.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.